Good evening and welcome. My name is Susan Morgenthau, and along with Darren Walker, I just have to say this, it is my privilege. I not only serve, but it truly is my privilege to serve as a co-chair of the Library's Council. So on behalf of our entire council tonight, I'd like to thank you for being here for our program. And I'd really especially like to thank the conservator members who are in our audience. The membership programs, such as the one you are about to enjoy, are really here to thank our conservators for their generous and steadfast support. They are also designed so that our conservators can bring guests with them, so that we can give you the opportunity as guests to reveal the extent and to learn about the extent of the library's collections and our mission. We literally reach millions of information seekers, both online and in person, every year. The library has vast collections, world-class staff, and outstanding services. We offer literacy programs, resume writing classes, we have internet access, and of course, we simply help one to find a book on any subject for the sheer joy of reading it. These services are available free of charge to anyone who walks in our doors. That is really very important, and compared to the other cultural institutions in New York, it makes us unique. We do not charge admission, and as long as we can remain open in our branches, in our research libraries, and for evenings like this, then with your help, we will remain free. So if you're here as a guest tonight, I do hope you will consider joining us as a member. Before I introduce our guest, I would like to specifically thank Jadrian Steele. He is the Assistant Director of Individual Giving here at the library, and he is responsible for, among many things, the management of the Library Council and its programs. Tonight's program was conceived and organized solely by Jadrian in a specific attempt to tie our membership's interest to the library's collections. And I hope you get a chance to thank him tonight on your way out. I'm sure it will be an illuminating discussion. And also, it's going to be an opportunity for you, and I have to admit as well for myself, to learn more about the treasures in the Lionel Pincus and Princess Farrell map division. They have benefited greatly from all of the outstanding upgrades in computer technology that the library has invested in. We have 51 million items in our collections. Tonight, we will shine a light on just one aspect of these holdings, an in-depth look at the historical maps of Wall Street. We're fortunate to have two expert tour guides with us this evening, Edwin Burroughs and Matthew Knutson. Mr. Burroughs is a distinguished professor of history at Brooklyn College and is co-author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Gotham, A History of New York to 1898. He literally wrote the book on what we are about to discuss. His most recent publication, Forgotten Patriots, The Untold Story of American Prisoners During the Revolutionary War, is the first ever account of thousands of American prisoners of war who lost their lives during the war for independence. Currently, he is working on a book about the Crystal Palace, which stood directly to our west on the site of what is now Bryant Park. Mr. Burroughs is joined tonight by the library's own Matthew Knutson, who is, and I don't know how many of you in the audience tonight knew of this particular title, but I think it might be unique in libraries. I'm not sure, Matthew, you can speak to this. He is the geospatial librarian for the New York Public Library. For close to 9 years, Matthew has been responsible for managing the reading rooms, physical collections, and digital activities. One of his primary roles here at the library has been to facilitate and integrate new computer technologies into traditional map research and the library processes. Matthew himself is a practicing cartographer and a visual artist. He has published and exhibited his work both here in New York and abroad. Gentlemen, we thank you and we welcome you both. Thank you.
Well, I'm thinking that I should become a geospatial professor of history. give my title a little credibility. I am a professor of history, however, and I want to assure you before we start that none of this will be on the final exam, so you don't have to take notes. What I thought would be fun, since we're going to be talking about Wall Street this evening, is to begin with a very short course, kind of reminding ourselves of what the history of Wall Street is like and how much Wall Street has changed over time. And I'd like to begin with a fairly obvious point that, see if I can make this work again. There we go. I'm sure everybody here is aware that Wall Street is called Wall Street because there was a wall on it at one time. It was put up by the Dutch to protect New Amsterdam from a potential attack by the English and the Indians, whichever came first. No attack did materialize, but the line of the palisade gave the street its name. What we often, what we often don't know is how small New Amsterdam was. And I want to draw your attention to the shaded blocks on this map, which emphasize that even though New Amsterdam represented the southern tip of Manhattan, in those days, the 17th century, Manhattan was a good deal narrower than it is now. And we're going to talk about landfill and how made land extended the length of Wall Street over time. Wall Street represented the northern boundary of New Amsterdam. Beyond that, there was no built-up area. And in fact, that would remain true well into the 17th century. This is a map. There we go. I got it back. I don't know what did I do. It's that spatial orientation. This is the Castello Plan. We're going to also talk a little bit more about this as we go on. It's called the Castello Plan because it was found in a castle in Italy at some point by someone. It represents a very detailed image of New Amsterdam about 4 years before the English conquest of 1664. And you can see quite clearly Wall Street at the northern perimeter of the what was in effect a little village at that time. It was a palisade constructed largely out of sharpened stakes. There were two gates in it. One gate on the East River was known, interestingly enough, as the Water Gate, and the gate on the Hudson River side was known as the Land Gate. Eventually, the little canal that's on Broad Street, you can see it sort of arcing up to the junction of Broad Street, what is now Broad Street and Wall Street, would be filled in after the English conquest. But Wall Street represented, as I said, the northern boundary of the built-up area of first New Amsterdam and then New York well into the 1670s or 1680s. But New York would grow under the British Empire. As a part of the British Empire, it profited greatly from especially the West Indian trade, and slowly but surely the population expanded. And as the population expanded, the city began to grow up the island of Manhattan. This is a city plan from the 1730s. See if I can point this out successfully. Can you see that little red dot there? This is Wall Street right along here. By the 1730s or so, the population of New York had risen to about 12,000 people. It was really a good-sized village. It was only the third largest port in British North America. It was behind Boston and Philadelphia still. But Wall Street had moved, so to speak. It hadn't physically moved, but the city had grown up around it. So that it was roughly midway between the Battery and what would eventually be City Hall Park. What's interesting about Wall Street, though, is that, well, two things. It was a kind of axis of power in colonial New York. And I say this because of a couple of important features. At the western end of Wall Street was Trinity Church, which was the established church in New York and would remain established until after the American Revolution. Just a little bit down the way at the intersection of Broad and Wall Street was City Hall. This is the second building that served as a city hall for colonial New York. So that if you were to walk down Wall Street, you'd sort of hit all the important institutions. And then all the way at the very foot of Wall Street, at about the corner of Water Street now, that is several blocks inland from the East River in those days, stood something called the Meal Market. And the Meal Market was so named because that's where grains were brought into the city to be bought and sold. But it also served as the city's slave market. And for most of the 18th century, slaves were bought and sold at the Meal Market. So if you walk along Wall Street, you sort of touch all the bases. You get religious power, you get political power, and you get the reminder that 20% of the population of New York City in the 17th and 18th centuries was African American, most of them enslaved. Something else is apparent from this map, and it's going to be more apparent as we go on, is that the shoreline of, particularly the East River shoreline of Manhattan, is being pushed out a little bit. The city of the government of the city is creating what were called water lots, and those water lots were designed to increase revenue for the municipal corporation. And essentially what it meant was that they would fill in block by block along into the East River. And what that created, slowly but surely, was additional blocks at the foot of Wall Street. So by the time the meal market was sort of standing right out here, it was on the, really, just off the shore of what is now Water Street. But keep your eye on that, because as time goes on, it's going to move further and further inland as the shore expands. By the time of the American Revolution, in the 1770s, I'll get this, there we go, the configuration of the island had changed even more, but Wall Street represented still a important political and social axis in the life of the city. Despite that, it was a residential street. Only about one out of every six or seven buildings along Wall Street was used for other than residential purposes. It was a place where people lived and worked, and you can see the, I'm pushing the wrong button on this thing all the time, but here's Trinity Church at the western terminus of Wall Street, and then it runs down here, and you can see, if you look closely, it's hard to see it from a distance in the audience, but Wall Street has now extended out a couple of more blocks. Water Street was known as Queen Street in those days. Front Street has been developed, and even South Street has appeared, a couple of blocks of South Street. So slowly but surely, as the city grows, Wall Street becomes longer. And that's something I want you to keep in mind, because it's going to affect how we read some of these maps. It was a residential street. Well, I'm going to see if I can make this go back. This is a modern artist's image of what Upper Wall Street looked like in the days around the time of the American Revolution. It was a residential street. This is a scene that would be repeated over and over again. And I want you to think about this as we get into the later 19th century, when families disappear and Wall Street ceases to be a residential street. Nevertheless, significant changes were on the way. Oh, I'm going the wrong direction. I'll get the hang of this. Significant changes were on the way in the years after the American Revolution. One of the important changes that took place was, as you may recall, for a very brief period of time, New York City was the capital of the United States. And City Hall, the building that stood at the juncture of Broad and Wall Street, was in fact renovated for the use of the federal government. And it would remain used by the federal government for maybe a year or two. And then, thanks to Alexander Hamilton, our own native son, he sold us out, and the federal government moved down to Philadelphia on its way to Washington, D.C. The departure of the federal government, which was lamented by many people at the time, may actually have turned out to be a good thing for New York. The United States is interesting among major cities of the world because we have a separation of political power and economic power. If you think of London or Paris or other major cities, the biggest city, the most important city culturally and politically, is also the seat of the government. That's not true for New York. And when the federal government moved out in 1790, it sort of freed up New York to develop sort of outside of governmental scrutiny. And I think you could make a good case that, in fact, New York benefited enormously from the departure of all those senators and representatives that we know and love so well. They all went down, you know, to Philadelphia. Within a few years after the departure of the federal government, in fact, Wall Street began to change. Slowly but surely, inexorably, it began to change. Within a matter of a year or two after the departure of the federal government, the New York Stock Exchange was organized. within a year or two after that, the Tontine Coffee House, which is the building that you see there on the left. A coffee house was a place where merchants would get together and do business. And in fact, not long after this building was constructed, it became the actual seat of the New York Stock Exchange in 1794. The New York Stock Exchange actually occupied the second floor of the Tontine Coffee House, and I think that the picture of those gentlemen on the balcony there probably represents some early stockbrokers. Notice also that this is a picture of Wall Street. Wall Street's running this way, sort of through the front of the painting. And this is the corner of Wall and Water Street, and we can look down Wall Street already toward the South Street waterfront. This picture conveys something of how quickly Wall Street was extended in the 18th and early 19th centuries. It's a much longer street by this time than it was when it appeared. City Hall was going to move, but Wall Street was slowly but surely being colonized by business. The entire Wall Street area, interestingly enough, still remained largely residential, even in the 1790s and early 1800s. This is a picture looking up Broad Street toward City Hall, or Federal Hall, as it was sometimes called. And you can see the mixture of small businesses and artisan shops and stores and so forth, along with private residences. But as I said, in the early decades of the 19th century, the early 1800s, business was inexorably pushing out the residents from Wall Street, and that would lead to some important changes. Banks began to appear on Wall Street in the early 1800s. By the first couple of decades of the 19th century, New York's population grew. It was roughly around 1810 that New York passed Philadelphia to become the biggest city in the United States. And it's not surprising, I think, that around the same time that was happening, banks were beginning to cluster along Wall Street. In the 1820s and 1830s, there was a tremendous upsurge of commercial establishments that landed on Wall Street. And I think if we look at some of these maps later on, we'll begin to see how commercial buildings, banks, insurance companies, brokerage houses begin to displace private residences from Wall Street. This is one of my favorite buildings. It's the Bank of the United States, which was constructed on Wall Street in 1826. If you look very carefully to the left, you can see what is still the Federal Hall National Memorial. This building was torn down in 1905, but the facade was preserved in the American wing of the Museum of Modern Art. And if you hadn't seen that, the Metropolitan Art, sorry, not Modern Art, that would be highly unlikely to see a building like this in the Museum of Modern Art. So this is a process that begins to accelerate in the early 1800s. The transformation of Wall Street is getting longer, but it's also becoming less and less residential, and very quickly. One of the things that accelerates this transformation of Wall Street is fire. There were two great fires in early 19th century New York. One of them was the Great Fire of 1835, which was sort of the granddaddy of massive conflagrations in New York. It destroyed over 700 buildings in the business district of the city, most of it in the area east of Broad Street and south of Wall Street. I mean, it's a very compact area, so much of that was completely wiped out by this fire. And the fire obviously had the effect of clearing the ground for more development. One of the things that was lost in that fire was a building known as the Merchants Exchange. Merchants Exchange was another one of those buildings where businessmen would get together and do deals. The original building burned in the upper left-hand corner. It was replaced by a new Merchants Exchange, which stood on the south side of Wall Street, built in the fashionable Greek Revival style. It has survived, at least portions of it, as the Regent Wall Street Hotel. Throngs of people pass by it every time. The dome is no longer there. It's not visible from the street. But if you go in it, it's highly recommended. Just go in it and wander around the lobby. It's a magnificent building. But it's emblematic of how the built environment of Wall Street would change as the result of fires.
There was another fire in 1845 that did some more damage, not quite as much. This is an explosion that occurred that triggered the fire. This fire in 1845 destroyed another 350 buildings. That must have pretty much taken care of everything that existed at the time. Another 350 buildings south of Wall Street toward Bowling Green. There were a lot of fatalities during these fires, but the 1845 fire was put out fairly quickly, much more quickly than the 1835 fire, thanks, among other things, to a better organized fire department and the advent of Croton water, which made it possible to fight fires more effectively. In the decades before, just before the Civil War then, Wall Street had been pretty much transformed. What had been a residential street at the time of Washington's inauguration in 1789 had, well before Lincoln's inauguration in 1861, well before Lincoln's inauguration, had been completely changed. It was no longer a residential street. I've heard it said that in 1850 the census found one family living someplace on Wall Street, and I'd love to know, you know, where they were and who they were, because they were the last permanent residents of Wall Street for what would really be another 100 years or so. That's going to change, as you know, in the 1970s when residents begin moving back to Wall Street. That's another chapter in the story. But by 1850, give or take, Wall Street had become what we know as the commercial center of New York and, to a large extent, the commercial center of the United States. That's a change that happened very quickly. It was almost a revolutionary change in Wall Street, not only in its physical extent, but also in the nature of what took place on Wall Street. This is a map of New York in 1850. It's known as the Drips map, after the artist who drew it. You can see, if you look really carefully, that Wall Street, which at the time of the American Revolution or even the English conquest had been the northern boundary of town, has suddenly been displaced and is now way downtown. And New York has grown massively. The population of New York was now about 800,000 when this map was drawn. So there's been a radical transformation in the city around New York itself. One last thing which I want to just share with you is, and we'll talk some more about this, this is the famous Veal map. It's known as the water map of New York because it shows the original shoreline and the original location of streams and ponds and lakes, of which there were quite a number on Manhattan before it was taken over by the city. You can see from this map that Wall Street has been extended down to the present by probably a third its original length. So when we talk about the history of Wall Street, we have to be clear that we're talking about a street that's actually growing in length over time. Pearl Street was the original shoreline of Manhattan. Now it's been pushed out across Water Street, Front Street, South Street, all the way to the FDR Drive. It's a much longer street than it was when it was the northern boundary of Little New Amsterdam. I think I have one more picture that I want to just show. Yes. One of my favorite pictures of the new Wall Street is this kind of image of bankers and brokers, the panic of 1857. There are a number of things that are interesting about this. Trinity Church that you see in the background is the third iteration of that building to stand on that site. It was constructed in the 1840s, I think, if that's roughly right. But what you see is a place that has been completely changed now. There are no families. There are no mothers and children playing in the street the way you saw in that artist's image of what Wall Street had been in the 1790s. And the space, interestingly enough, has become taken over, in a sense, by men. It's now, Wall Street is now very much a male space, and one of the things that contemporaries often talked about was how women and children have, at least respectable women and children have been driven out of Wall Street because it's no longer a residential street, it's now a commercial center. And I will leave you with that thought. Okay.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Okay. I'm gonna breeze through the first couple centuries that you covered so nicely, and tell you to pick up at about the middle of the 19th century. But along the way, I want to tell you a little bit about what we're doing in the Lionel Pincus and Princess Fiorel Map Division to make our collections more accessible, and to make the type of writing of history and the discovery, like you do, more sort of readily possible through new map technology. Okay, so without any further ado, here we go. Okay, so the collection of the Lionel Pincus and Princess Fiorel Map Division is around 500,000 maps, and we cover the entire globe at a wonderful scale of incredible detail, oftentimes down to building level. In this case, I'm going to zoom in here, and then I'll explain what you're looking at. Okay, if we zoom in here, too, this is a version of an early map of the Dutch West India Company. Excuse me, it's going to zoom in a little bit. Okay, there we go. Okay, so what you're looking at here is a map that depicts 1640, and it's overlaid in Google Earth. As part of what we do at the Map Division, we've created a system whereby we can digitize maps, and we can bring those maps into a system, into a software system to georectify them. So I'm going to throw another, this is another terminology, high terminology piece that I'm throwing out. At being the geospatial librarian, I feel entitled to be able to do these sorts of things. What georectification is if you break up that word, think of it as geo and rectify, so to make right by the world. You're taking points of equivalency. You're saying this point right here along Wall Street equals a contemporary equivalent on a modern map. And by doing that over and over and over and over, we bring these maps into alignment with one another. So you see this map of the original Grants. It's kind of fun to look at also. This is being rendered in Google Earth. You see this map overlaid on contemporary Lower Manhattan. And this is the actual shoreline as it was in 1640. So one of the beautiful things about a highly powerful, totally ubiquitous GIS, geographic information rendering system, like Google Earth. They like to say that they're the GIS providers for those, you know, 5.9 billion people who can't afford all of the commercial GIS software. I'm not pitching for them, but it is a fantastic application, and now our maps are available on here. So we can run back and forth and see a transparency to actually prove the fact that I'm not lying to you. This is the original coastline. If I can get this mouse to cooperate a little bit, we can see the dramatic change in shoreline. I mean, this is truly phenomenal. The amount of made land we see here between Pearl Street and the FDR. So one of the sort of imperatives that we have in the map division is to be able to bring these things in alignment with one another, to study and to georectify maps, and in order to see what's underneath the ground, to see the relationship between what's here now and what once was on the ground. So we can zoom into this, and we can fiddle over details and look in this and see all of the Dutch landowners' names and where the sheep's pasture was and all of this. What this is allowing us to do also is not just an interesting way to render maps and to look at things one on top of the other. It's allowing us to create an infrastructure, a geographic and a historic infrastructure, to think of it like a wireframe of space and time that we can attach different objects to. So I've done that, but I've just done it with a couple of things that I've picked out from the vast digital collections at the library. So we have a digital database called the Digital Gallery. And in the Digital Gallery, we have close to 800,000 images spanning space and time. I did an estimate a few years back that more than one quarter of those images, so that's 200,000 images, relate to New York City in some sort of way, either through an address or this is such and such's house, and they relate to a specific time. So if we have a space and a time, we know that we can link that to a map. So in this case, we have another image of the Palisade here, and we can link directly right out to that same image in the digital gallery. It looks pretty good up there, so I don't want to go messing around with that right now. But that's what the Palisade looks like at around the time when this map was made. You notice at the top here, too, I haven't showed you this yet, this is a time slider. So all of this information that comes out of both the map servers, and I'm going to turn around, excuse me, I don't mean to be rude, I'm going to crane my neck a little bit so I can see what I'm doing. But we have up here is called the time slider. So we can move back and forth. So what you're looking at is a visualized map chronology that we can attach any sort of historical digital object to, as well as historical maps. So this is the redraft of the Castello plan, which you showed earlier. This is done in 1915 by Ian Phelps Stokes for the Stokes Iconography of Manhattan Island, which is a wonderful, wonderful, amazing, rich, deep work on the history of Manhattan Island. You should all read it front to back, all six volumes. It's so tremendous.
Collector's item.
Collector's item, too, yeah. And this is not only just an interesting map because it shows the geography. This one lines up incredibly well. This is the street grid of Lower Manhattan now, and you can see the shoreline right here. And it's a wonderful amount of detail on this map, too, to the extent that we can, excuse me if it flips back and forth a little bit, this mouse is a little bit finicky. You can see we can change our orientation a little bit here, flip things around, and you can see that this is actually an axonometric drawing. And if we go in far enough, we can see the little houses that were rendered. Right. We can see the people marching around in formation in some cases, and then somebody's just driving a haystack over to market or something like that over here. This is the Bowling Green, which was a nice sledding hill, I heard, at some point. Also, one of the few places that you could sled in the island. And we can go up to Wall Street also, and we can see that the Palisade is, of course, as of 1660, was still there.
And you can also see, by the way, if I just added in, that the residences that are along Wall Street are all on the south side of Wall Street. The wall is on the north side of the street, so everybody lives on the south side of that street. The other thing that's remarkable is how accurately the present street plan of Lower Manhattan reflects the street plan of New Amsterdam. Even though there is nothing survives of New Amsterdam, it's all been lost hundreds of years ago. To travel back into Lower Manhattan in your SUV on a workday is to travel back into time. You really, when you go to Wall Street nowadays, you're going back in time to the 17th century. It's a remarkable thing to think about it, and these maps help underscore what's really happening.
Hanover Square. That's what? Am I right about where my hand is now?
Yeah, I would think.
Yeah, right about down there. You looking for someone? They might be on this map.
He's looking for his house.
I can see my house from here.
And actually, the owners and occupants of all of these buildings have been identified historically, and I'd like to think that eventually that information will be available on this map so that you could actually interactively go to a particular house and see who was actually living there at any point in time.
That's where we're taking this, and that's really exciting to know that data exists. I'm salivating right now. So we can see in another image here. Here's Pearl Street. Around the same time this map was produced. This might be a sensationalized view. We talked a little bit about that in particular, the maps from the Valentine manuals from the middle of the 19th century, or the views, that is.
Right.
This is from a collection at the library. I believe this is from the mid-Manhattan Library Collection. You can see the gate outside of the city. This looks like there's actually some building to the north of Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is Wall. This is Wall and Pearl Street, Wall and Pearl. What we're looking at here is myself putting these things, pinning these things onto a map. But what we're doing and what we're paving, breaking the ground to do is making this possible in a data-driven way so that we know we can pin massive amounts of data to maps like this. And I'm going to scroll forward. I said I was going to go to the middle of the 19th century, and I didn't. So let's move forward a little bit here to the time of the American Revolution. Scroll forward, and we can see this map. Wow. And these maps are streaming right from the NYPL servers, which I think is very, very exciting. We can see a lot of big changes. This is Bernard Ratzer's map. And if you want to just take a look, a zoomed out look, this map goes all the way up to Inklenberg, which is Robert Murray's farm. And here's Murray Hill up here, all the way down past the Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn to the wooded heights of Gowana over here, over to Newtown Creek. You can see about half or a third of Governor's Island, the rest of which was filled from a subway, right, from the subway tunnel.
Hadn't heard that, but
yeah, I think the Broadway line fill was used to create the lower two-thirds of Governor's Island. So it's a wonderful map, but it also has a tremendous amount of detail. So you can see in here data that my brain has been making me think about this stuff as data lately. And it gets me really excited because on this map, we have these dotted lines representing wards. And like you were talking about, this is a heavily residential area.
Mm-hmm.
And these wards are named wards that exist in databases run by the Mormons, the Ancestry.com library databases that most of the major libraries subscribe to. All of this information is keyed into these wards. So nobody's done census analysis for the revolutionary America, Revolutionary War period America, but it's quite possible doing this. So we can watch and see what sort of population density was happening at this point using the data from this map. And it's cartographic information. It's geospatial information. And so we're looking to harvest that and mine that and then link it to a whole bunch of other stuff like ornaments. So we can see this is a map. This is Poppleton's map here from 1817. And we have a couple of images of Trinity Church. I think you were mentioning that the modern ones were built in the 1840s, and I think that's right because this image here is from 1827, and then we have one as of 1835 that shows the fire. It shows it had burned down as a part of this 1835 fire. So this is an article detailing how the church was burnt down from 1835. And then we can scroll forward on this map. You can see also just interesting things popping out, like this is the just after the War of 1812, and we have many sort of fortifications. There's the North Battery. Actually, there's a bunch of batteries here along the North River. There's a battery up here, I think, by Gansvert Street.
Mm-hmm. It's called the White Battery, I think.
The White Battery, okay, which I think lasted and was there until the 1850s or something. And then we have this battery down at sort of which is Castle Clinton now. This is where the mm-hmm. and you notice you don't have to walk across a causeway anymore to get to Castle Clinton, and that's because it was filled in. So we can see. I'm going to flip back in just a second. This is 1867, and this is Drips's map from 1867 that shows the infilling here. Other things that I've just sort of picked out of our digital gallery is a handwritten something by Walt Whitman, and it had an address scrawled on the back that said 50 Broad Street. Yeah. So this has something. This is just a piece of ephemera by somebody famous that has to do with the place. Here we go. I don't know what this image is. This is a street view of Broad Street, presumably from the 1860s at that point, Broad and Wall. But flipping back, I want to show you this map and talk a little bit about this. This is William Parris's atlas, Maps of the City of New York, and this is his first fire insurance atlas. this. And this is this was published originally in 1852 and marches all the way up, showing every building on the island up until 42nd Street in this edition. There are more from that first edition that we don't have in the collections here. And if we get our hands on them, we'll digitize them. But this is a fire insurance atlas, and William Paris was an enterprising Englishman who had surveying chops and came to the United States after two huge fires decimated whole big parts of Lower Manhattan, and found a really brilliant niche in mapping all of the structures. And they mapped all the structures for the purposes of mitigating fraud and writing appropriate insurance policies. And in the process, they mapped out the city, and I know this is zooming in really far, but it's fun to see, mapping out the city to a tremendous amount of detail, including things like contemporary building addresses. This is critical. This is totally critical. Mm-hmm. And the reason being is that addresses change. You know the history of New York City. Blocks get wiped out. Whole building complexes go up in the place where there were many, many, many homes. And so if you have documentation or something related to an old place, like, say, a letter your great-grandfather wrote or something like that, you have no context. And this is the context. And it's here. And this technology is enabling us to recontextualize this, to regain that context and to unlock the past, the link to the past. So if you can see, it's a little bit hard to see because these are all blue buildings, meaning they're commercial. And that's another interesting sort of point here, is that these are commercial enterprises, so they're blue. But there's a whole building code system which exists on here, which tells us about the buildings. Pink is brick or stone. You can vaguely see. It's really faint. Yellow is a wooden-framed building. Green is specially hazardous, which means that it's probably going to explode in the next couple hours because they're doing something with turpentine in the basement or something, or they're making glue or whatever toxic thing. And the dots on here indicate the class of building materials. So think of this as being just the most expensive versus the least expensive. So first-class building materials have got a slate roof, and they've got coping on the siding that's going to be a fire retardant and resistor. And then fourth-class buildings, or third here in third-class, it all goes all the way to fourth-class buildings, are the cheapest building materials. So one of the wonderful things about these maps is that we can, pardon the expression, read between the contours. We can figure out a whole bunch of other information. We can infer things like social class and all sorts of different types of geographic layers through this data. What I find really just very interesting about this is watching these things evolve through time. So this is just the beginning of this type of mapping. We have tens of thousands of sheets that come up to the present day. And to date, we have about 3,500 of these digitized. And over the next 3 years, we just received word that we have grant funding to digitize another about 9,000 of these maps and bring them into the same system here. So we'll be able to scroll through sort of flipbook style historical maps of New York City. But back to Wall Street a little bit, these maps are really wonderful documentation of what was going on and of some of the banking activities. Here's the Customs House. There's all of these named buildings here.
There's about 8 or 9 banks on one block of Wall Street.
It's a tremendous amount of activity going on here. There's the exchange with the dome. One of the resources we have in the division and throughout the library collections are directories, things like business directories. So if you look at these buildings, each one of these buildings had a whole lot of activities going on. Well, the big banks were probably just single big banks. But all of these buildings over here can be identified by address. And on every floor, there's something else going on. There's lawyers on one floor. There's brokers on another floor. There's a telegraph company on another floor. So through a reverse directory, I found a whole lot of telegraph companies, which I guess had sprouted up since the invention of telegraphs, but were right here. And because this is where economic activity was happening. This is where people needed to have instantaneous communication about what was happening at the market. You know, my wheat crop, oh boy, it's trouble this year, and you know, and you guys better hustle and figure out what to do. There's cobblers, there's millinaries, there's, you know, all sorts of interesting industrial activities going on that I have no clue what they mean.
And to be able to trace that over time, how those businesses come and go, it would be absolutely fascinating. And it would say a lot about how Wall Street changes.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really, I think it's one of the most exciting things about the system we've built, for one, and the collections, merging these with the collections. And this, I mean, really, this all of this work is, well, let me just give a little bit of credit to the former curator of the map division who's sitting right here, Alice Hudson. Thank you very much, Alice, for making it possible to get us to the point where we can bring all of these maps into a highly conserved, preserved fashion so that they can sort of be on this launch pad and be ready to sort of become data and become alive again. Okay, so this is 1885. I'll continue on the tour a little bit here. And then I'll just show you a little bit about how this is done, just for a brief minute. This is a really fun image here from the Mid-Manhattan Picture Collection. You can see this is an 1885 map, and you have an elevated streetcar line running right through Coentis Slip here and around Battery Park and down to the ferry terminal. One of the things these maps illustrate all the time is just the tremendous amount of change that happens. One year there's an elevated train, the next year there's no elevated train. So if you're living here on this street, all of a sudden you've got, you know, 10 years of having this just this incredible noise outside, and then it's gone, and the street's widened, and then this happens, and then that happens. And we sort of tend to not notice at all, like that there's a new 63-story building across the street that just went up in a year or two, Bank of America. We just tend to not notice this at all. But once you start looking at this stuff with respect to itself, sort of one layer on top of the other, you just see this is just, it's a fantastic amount of change. So you can see here a lovely view of that elevated streetcar. So this is what we're hoping to do sort of en masse. And when I initially did a search, I was going to, my plan for tonight was to bring together all of the resources we had for Wall Street, all of the images, but it was thousands of images, and there was just no way that I could sort of make heads or tail of that. It just didn't make sense. So that sort of gives you an indication as to the raw materials that are there, and that's really what this is about. This is about creating an environment for the raw materials to be expressed on a map so that people who know and write and study and are interested in and are doing tests about history and geography can do so with a new kind of way, in a visually informed and a map-based way. I'm biased, of course, because I think we should all do our studying and research by maps.
You know, I think you're being much too modest, actually, about this. There are two things that are going on here. I don't mean to anticipate anything that you would say, but one of them is to increase the accessibility of information, which has always been out there, but nobody has ever been able to sort of put it together in the way that this is taking place. And it's very exciting to see different kinds of information being assembled and made accessible. I mean, you can do this sitting at home. I don't know whether he mentioned that yet. You can sit at home in the privacy of your own home and play around with these maps to your heart's content. And that is increasing the accessibility of information on a scale that we haven't seen ever before. But the other thing is that when you do this, when you put all of this stuff together, it's not just making old information accessible, it's creating new things. I mean, you know, there's the famous story about Benjamin Franklin. In Paris, he went to watch the balloon go up in the air, and somebody standing next to him said, "Well, what good is a hot air balloon?" And he said famously, probably apocryphally, "What good is a newborn baby?" I mean, this is the newborn baby. We don't know. We really don't know. People who do this kind of research, who write and study history, don't know what this is going to produce. I mean, we're just on the very beginning edge of something that I think is very exciting.
Exactly, and I mean, and that's something that I tell people more and more and more. And as we're going out to our different colleagues in various different universities and school settings here throughout the city, as well as our colleagues at the library, different curators and different divisions that have information that right. somehow relates to the city, that's the message I continue to hammer away on, is that, you know, I'm not the one that knows all of the stuff out there and how it all relates to it. Don't look to me for that. You know, look at this and see how this could apply. This is just a framework. You know, this is just a paradigm through which you could study your own stuff and through which we could relate collections to one another and make them useful sort of beyond just what they are in and of themselves. Just like the folks who were making, I always draw the analogy, just like the folks who were making the fire insurance maps, were making fire insurance maps for fire insurance maps. They probably weren't thinking that we were going to be studying, you know, social class by looking at building structures, you know, 150 years later. But now this is totally entirely possible. And along the same lines, we're looking, and we've just compiled a list of business and social directories here at the library. And there are something around 75,000 pages for New York City in business and social directories published between 1786 and about 1850 that could potentially be pulled and rendered and viewed in this sort of way. So 78,000 pages, not bits of information. So you can imagine the sort of wealth of personal information that can come out of here. There's additionally some folks who are sociologists who are very, very interested in unpacking census data from different points in time. And because we have addressing on these things, those census data can be, pardon, I'm slipping in my tongue, that census data can be unpacked by building. And each one of the buildings of New York throughout these various different steps in the census can be visualized based on the percentage of Hungarian residents in this building or the percentage of French residents, whatever it is, and we can watch literally a building transform through time. That's on the most granular level. We have to think about these things sort of broad-based first. You know, we'll get the maps in place first. We'll start taking out the big components of political geography like the ward boundaries, and then we can start getting into more of the fine detail.
Sure. Absolutely.
Sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And we'd be delighted to.
Well, we'll take questions. I don't know that we'll answer them. But
thank you. Thank you for the caveat.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm asking whether maps exist of what's underneath the street level, whether it's water or street utilities or the subway, and how it's changed, and whether you can track that to what's going on above the street.
To some extent, we have maps that show stuff underground. I mean, on this one right here, they started showing water mains at a certain point because these were used for... these were used by fire companies, water mains and fire hydrants. There's very little sort of deep infrastructural information, though. On some of the later maps, there's information about what was going on in basements of buildings. The water map, the VLE water map, which you mentioned earlier, shows some of the old stream networks and the old hydrographic network of the island of Manhattan. And sometimes that rears its head under different people's homes and things like that during big rainstorms. Most of the water is culverted, and most of it runs off of the surfaces of the streets of the island. But there's not really that much that exists in our collections that relates to the deep infrastructure. A lot of that's in data format, and now is maintained by some of the different city agencies.
There we go.
I have an ancestor who, in 17, she was a woman who was in the export-import business. And she owned Hanover Square in the 1770s, about there. Would you be able to help me find out exactly where she lived? I mean, I have a family map.
Yes. I'd like to say yes. I mean, we can do our best, and what we do for this type of research question is to bring everything that we have available out, and then we can point to different kind of resources which might relate to that. So the old business directories, like I was saying, from 1786 are going to tell us a lot about, you know, just about that time frame. I mean, mm-hmm. there might be other resources that relate to that, census information as well. So there are different places where this research can happen throughout the library.
And pictures, perhaps, of what Hanover Square looked like at that time?
Surely, yeah. No, surely. Surely there are those. I mean, we could search them. We could search them here.
Thank you.
I think I can make myself heard even without this. But I wanted to ask about water, natural water, which has appeared in so many buildings down in Lower Manhattan. And do you have any records of these streams, or because it's fresh water apparently that turns up in buildings downtown?
Well, yes. I mean, engineers have mapped a lot of that. I think the Vili map that I mentioned earlier and that we just saw contains a lot of the original streams and swamps and marshes of Manhattan. Like Minetta Brook, for example, is still there. you know, they've been as Matthew said, they've been culverted over, but they're still there, and under the wrong circumstances, they can make everybody quite uncomfortable.
There's a general awareness, and this is all the technology that we use to make these maps appear in this place in Google Earth is all open source technology. So what that means is that it's license free. It's not license free, but it's a very open license. It's the software can be used, cracked open, put together in any kind of configuration by a software developer for any library there is. So there are different library efforts which utilize different aspects of this. So the National Library of Scotland is very forward-thinking in terms of their map collection and the way they visualize and introduce maps to the world. One of the things that I think is wonderful is the confluence here and of this incredibly dense place here that we have that's confined by this, you know, whatever we are, 24 square miles on this island, and you know, a couple hundred years of history compressed into this very small space makes using this really just the most sort of natural and the richest test case that we can do for this kind of thing. So that said, there are different efforts and different things going on in map libraries around that haven't been brought out to the public to this extent. And just as an aside, it's something that that you mentioned just a minute ago, was that this is something you can do from home. So the software allows users to go in and actually georectify imagery and actually trace and pull information off of these maps. So it penetrates a worldwide market, and it allows people to come in and add value. So that aspect of it really hasn't been realized in different models of this. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but
one thing that I would add to that is that Manhattan is unique in how much of it has been destroyed over the years. There are no structures, well, with one or two possible exceptions, no pre-revolutionary structures existing in modern New York. And to be able to go back to these maps and begin to reconstruct, not only in our mind's eye, but actually on paper, what the city looked like in, say, 1700 or 1650 is a remarkable thing, because so much of it has disappeared over the years.
Well, I think we're going to wrap it up there. So please give a warm hand to Mr. Burroughs and Mr. Knudsen. Thanks so much for coming.